Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Father Michael Lapsley tells his story of loss, survival, and renewal, and of how he travels the world, bringing inspiration and witness, because we are all in need of healing. And Peter Malone shares his thoughts and impressions about a film dedicated to reggae legend Bob Marley that he says is interesting, also for its insight into music, politics and culture. Working in a news environment means daily exposure to stories of war, violence, injustice, poverty and desperation. That's why it's so inspiring to come across men and women who have dedicated their lives to building peace, justice and reconciliation, who live in service to others. A while ago, I was given the opportunity to speak to someone whose story speaks of just that, life-giving peace and forgiveness and service to others. And I would add, respectful listening, emotional and spiritual healing, social healing, reconciliation, learning from the past, peace-building and restorative justice. He is Anglican Father Michael Lapsley, founder of the Institute for Healing Memories, that seeks to accompany other people on their journeys to healing and wholeness, both in South Africa, where it is based, and in many other countries where war, oppression, and conflict have created suffering. I met Father Lapsley at the American University of Rome, where he had been invited to deliver a lecture on young people and peace. And as I usually do when I sit down for an interview, I asked him to tell me a little about himself and what brought him here.
Well, I was born and brought up in New Zealand. I went to Australia to train to be a priest and to become a member of an Anglican religious order. And my community transferred me to South Africa in 1973. And I often say the day I arrived in South Africa, I stopped being a human being and became a white man. And I realized that I would need to become part of the liberation struggle if I was going to recover my own humanity in solidarity with black people struggling for their fundamental human rights in the land of their birth. I was a student in South Africa. I became a chaplain to three university campuses, two black and one white. In 1976, I was the national chaplain of Anglican students, which, of course, was the time of the Soweto uprising when many young people were imprisoned, tortured, killed, detained, and very large numbers went into exile. Shortly after that, I was expelled from South Africa, and I went to live in Lesotho, which, of course, is a small African country totally surrounded by South Africa. And it was there that I approached the African National Congress to become a member. And I realized that apartheid would not be ended by individual actions. It had to be by collective discipline, struggles of many people acting in concert that would eventually bring apartheid down. So I was to spend the next 16 years with the people living in exile, first in Lesotho, subsequently in Zimbabwe.
It was during those years of exile that his mission to be part of the struggle for justice caused him to travel the world with a message of hope.
Whilst I lived in Southern Africa, I traveled the world as part of the struggle against apartheid. And I suppose my message across the world at that time was simply to say that apartheid was a choice or an option for death carried out in the name of the gospel of life. I think for me what was particularly outrageous is that the apartheid state claimed to be Christian, claimed divine guidance, but apartheid said the most important thing about us is the color of our skin, where the gospel asserts that we all have infinite dignity and value because we're children of God. So they both can't be true, one had to be a lie. So my work was seeking to mobilize the faith community against apartheid across the world.
But while he was in Zimbabwe, something terrible happened to him, something that forced him to find resources within himself and his faith, and ultimately lead him to undertake his own personal journey of healing, forgiveness, and renewal.
In April of 1990, 3 months after the release of Mandela, I received a letter bomb, and in the process lost both hands and eye, eardrums were shattered, and many other injuries. And yet somehow I felt that God was with me, present in my suffering. I always felt that Mary, who watched her son being crucified, understood what it was that I was going through. A little bit of the time, I thought it would be better to be dead. I had never met someone with no hands, so I couldn't imagine what life would be like. But because of the years of traveling across the world, when I was bombed, there were messages of prayer, love, support. And that was what enabled me to make my bombing redemptive, to bring life out of death, good out of evil. I realized that if I was filled with hatred, bitterness, self-pity, desire for revenge, that I would be a victim forever. They would have failed to kill the body, but they would have killed the soul. So I was enabled to travel a journey beyond being a victim, beyond simply being a survivor, to become a victor, and to move, if you like, from being an object of history to becoming a subject of history once more. And I realized that the peoples of the world had accompanied me on my own journey of healing, and now it was time for me to return the compliment and begin the work of accompanying others on their journey of healing.
A long and painful recovery process, marked by moments of despair, reinforced Father Michael's determination to carry on fighting for justice and equality.
Now, when I returned to South Africa in 1992 to live, I realized that for millions of South Africans, unlike me, their stories had not been acknowledged and reverenced and recognized. People had not said what happened to you was wrong. And that led me with others to set up a process, an experiential workshop in particular, which we called a Healing of Memories workshop. And so my work has been very much about creating safe and sacred spaces where people could explore how the nation's journey had affected them psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, so that people could remember and yet not be controlled by their memories, not be prisoners of their memories, to find ways that people could, if you like, detoxify from the poison which is often connected to terrible memories. And by poison, I mean things like hatred and bitterness.
I read somewhere that you said that you felt you could be a better priest without hands than if you had had hands. Do you mean that people need a witness, need a figure to be able to understand and to be able to go ahead?
I'm not sure that so much people need, but they can identify with someone whom they see in front of them who clearly knows suffering and pain and loss and sacrifice. So they know, without you having said a word, that at a very profound level that there will be an understanding and appreciation. And I've come to see that pain is transcendent. And so I can be in a context where people are incredibly different in terms of their history, their appearance, their culture, but it's in the sharing of pain that we begin to connect to one another.
It reminds me of words I've heard from war veterans. They spoke to me of this incredible bonding that they had in moments of pain and fear. It's obviously something that can be transforming.
Yes, a great sense of solidarity. But what is, of course, also true of individuals, communities and nations, that often after terrible experiences, society moves on but leaves small or very large groups of victims without having had their pain acknowledged. And people often hold on to their victimhood, waiting for them to be acknowledged. If you think, you know, of the so-called comfort women in Korea, who still today, women in their 80s and 90s, are still demonstrating and saying to the Japanese, please acknowledge what it is that happened to us. And you can think of many, many examples around the world. And of course, we're here in Rome, and there has been the importance of some of the acknowledgement by the Holy Father of pain which was caused by the church to people. Of course, that needs to continue and extend, but acknowledgement can be the first step in the journey of healing.
Yes, as Father Michael points out, acknowledgement can be the first step in the journey of healing, just as every story, he says, needs a listener.
Well, you were also part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which did create the possibility for South Africa to go forward.
I came to the conclusion myself that South Africa proceeded on into the future based on two pillars. One was the need to meet the basic needs of the people for water, electricity, education, healthcare, all of those things, which we'll be seized with still for a very long time to come. But the other pillar was dealing with the past, dealing with what we have done to one another. And our Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a giant step along that road of facing the truth of what we had done to each other. And the commission was, in a way, like creating a huge mirror and putting it in front of a nation and saying, let's look into this mirror, let's see what it is that we have done to one another, because only by looking fully at it would we be able to begin to let it go. But I also realized that only a limited number of people would come to this commission. In fact, 23,000 people came and told their stories. Nearly 8,000 people came and asked for amnesty. But we're a country of 45 million. And so some of us said we need to create other safe and sacred spaces where any South African who wished to would be able to deal with how the nation's past had affected them. And that was really the thinking that lay behind what is today the Institute for Healing of Memories.
And today, he explains, the Institute for Healing of Memories takes that belief a step further by acknowledging the importance of forgiveness, reconciliation, and restorative justice in a whole range of situations.
In today's South African context, as well as working for national reconciliation, we work with refugees, especially refugee women. We work with people affected, infected by HIV and AIDS. We work with prisoners, recognizing as well that often those who do terrible things to others have had terrible things done to them. And so it's this question of how do we break the cycle that turns victims into victimizers.
I noticed actually a quote from your website. You say, all people are capable of being perpetrators or victims, and sometimes both.
Yes, I think as human beings, we tend to recognize our victimhood, but we're often blind to the ways in which we can at the same time be perpetrators. And of course, facing myself as a perpetrator means I've got to deal with emotions like guilt and shame. And that is why individuals and indeed whole nations go into denial about what happened. Because to face it is to face very uncomfortable feelings. And yet when we do face them, it's like the surgeon's knife. It can be extremely painful, but it can bring healing and certainly steps along the road to healing.
As I mentioned at the beginning, I was given the opportunity to meet and to speak with Father Lapsley here in Rome, where he had been invited by the American University of Rome to give a talk entitled Young People and the Art of Peace, together with the South African ambassador to Italy.
You're here today, Father Lapsley, to talk about young people and the art of peace.
I think there's this connection between the facing of the past and the creating of the future. And it is young people who hold the key to that. And I hope that my own presence and what I say may provide encouragement and inspiration to young people to say that history is created by all of us, and we can either choose to live selfish lives committed only to greed or power or privilege, or we can say we in our own lives will seek to make the world kinder, gentler, more just. And of course, part of that and part of the creation of peace is the creation of friendship across many lines. I think there's some urgency here in Europe where there is growing xenophobia, growing Islamophobia, to begin a new dialogue about how the other is also us. There is no other really. We are indeed one human family. And so I think young people, when they travel, when they go to visit other countries, create friendship, and also see the pain that often exists. I think all of that, if you like, incentivizes and inspires young people then to come back in this context and to work for social justice. Because I think it was Pope Paul VI who said, if you want peace, work for justice. And that's an underlying theme of what I would hope to share. But I would also want today to share something of my own life journey, of the choices I made, and encourage young people to think about their own life choices.
It's hard in this very materialistic world sometimes to try and pass on this responsibility almost to young people, isn't it?
I think we live in this acquisitive society, and we're all attracted by things, but I think there are also signs among young people of a recognition that that alone cannot satisfy, because we all need connection to other human beings to live meaningful and fruitful lives. And I think young people are quick to see if someone is fake or whether they're real. And also, as human beings, we have our deepest needs, our deepest longings are about connection and belonging and meaning. So I think that hopefully I can speak to those. And if you like, find the echoes in the hearts of those who I would be speaking to and interacting with. And to see that the more we create friendship across the world, the more meaningful our own lives become, the more we struggle for justice. We don't only give, but we also gain hugely. We end up with lives of deep satisfaction, which the materialistic option can never satisfy our deepest needs. And of course, it just encourages us to want to acquire more and more. And I think Catholic social teaching has spoken to this with great depth and consideration over many years, and inspired many people who themselves are not Roman Catholics, but see in that body of social teaching encouragement to life values.
Another subject I could not resist is Nelson Mandela. I had read on a website that, speaking of Father Lapsley, Mandela himself said, "Michael's life represents a compelling metaphor, a foreigner who came to our country and was transformed. His life," Mandela said, "is part of the tapestry of the many long journeys and struggles of our people."
You met Nelson Mandela. I know he's spoken of you. Can you tell me something about him?
Well, I suppose in a way, Nelson Mandela is an extraordinary human being, but he's also an embodiment of the best of South Africa. He was a product of our struggle. He not only led it, he embodied the best in us. I suppose what I have seen in Nelson Mandela, and I think increasingly the peoples of the world have seen, is a giant who sacrificed his life not for his own, for himself, but for others. So I think he has inspired me through much of my life, and profound honor that I've had the opportunity to meet him on a number of occasions.
A profound honor, I have no doubt. And for me, it was certainly a great honor to be able to meet and to speak with Father Michael Lapsley, a powerful witness of man's capacity, against all odds, to survive, forgive, and find the way of peace and reconciliation, and ultimately help others do the same. And now Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone shares his thoughts and impressions about a film dedicated to reggae legend Bob Marley. He says it's a welcome documentary, one that celebrates his spirit, his creativity, his genius and his influence, and offers glimpses of previously unseen and unheard Marley performances, and as much interview footage as filmmaker Kevin MacDonald could collect.
Yeah, this is my identity.
It is actually a biography, portrait of Jamaican composer and player Bob Marley. In one sense, it's a fairly classical biography, and they have plenty of time. It goes for almost 2.5 hours. A friend of mine who came into the preview likes 90-minute films, so he confided to me that he didn't think he'd be there by the end because it'd be repetitious and it was too long. But he was there at the end, and he had found it very interesting and enjoyable. So I can commend it, even if people think, oh, it's a long film. But we do get the outline of Marley's life. I hadn't realized he died at the age of 36. So he was born in 45, died in 81 of cancer.
He embraced the Rastafarian philosophy, and I think his religion would not allow him to seek the traditional cures for cancer.
Towards the end of his life, he did go to some German clinics, that's in the film, seeking some kind of relief for the cancer. But on the other hand, in his early life, with the Rastafarian beliefs or whether he created some of these, he smoked an enormous amount of marijuana, and that going in and out of his lungs all the time. I presume that must have had an effect as well.
So it had an effect on his music.
One of the difficulties with the film, because he's long dead, is that I suppose the clips of him in real life and interviews and some of the performances of his songs are fairly limited.
Important if me can help plenty people. My life is just me, my own security. Then you know what? My life is for people.
So he doesn't come across, or didn't come across to me as vividly as the people who were interviewed throughout the film, a lot of his associates.
Would never lock his car up. That's like saying you don't trust people.
A lot of fellow players, his wife, some of his children.
Him come from such a humble beginning. My father would always take us back to Trenchtown.
You must say they found him rather a difficult person.
All your parents do is smoke and play music. Nobody wanted their children around us.
And then some of his producers. So you do have a range of people who knew him, who worked with him, and are able to talk well about him, and they give a context to the clips you see of him and the interviews with him.
Are you a rich man? Do you have a lot of possessions?
Position make you rich? I don't have that type of richness. My richness is life.
But it takes you through his time in Jamaica, coming from a village, coming into Kingston, his mother leaving when he was 16, going to America, his growing up in a poorer part of Kingston, and then his music lessons, and then emerging fairly quickly as a musician and a composer. It goes on from there.
He also had a role in politics, in a way, in Jamaica. You say in your review that he performed and he was able to bring the two rival leaders of his country on stage to join their hands.
He was. When he came back after some of the tours, after Jamaican independence, there was a lot of fighting in the streets, thugs bashing people up, etc. And then elections were to come, I'm thinking it's 78, that he promises to do a concert. Then he regrets, because they bring a lot of, you know, political aspects into it. And then he is shot. And decides then that he will do the concert, he recovers. And he was able, as you said, to bring the two leaders of the time onto stage and get them to hold hands with him, some kind of unity. So to that extent, I suppose he became a significant figure in Jamaica once again, apart from the music. The other thing is, politically, he was invited to Zimbabwe for the independence, and they show a lot of scenes of that. And the director, I think with his tongue in cheek, actually has a clip from Robert Mugabe pledging himself to be at the service of the people, and it rings a bit hollow, you know, in view of subsequent history. But Marley was there, and a song for the independence of Zimbabwe. But again, he died the next year, so that there was no follow-up because of his death.
You touch a very delicate theme there. There are lots of clips of Mugabe pledging to be a servant to his people. Every time he is re-elected, he does that. But let's not go there, Peter. Let's go back to Bob Marley. Do you know that his wife and one of his sons, Stephen Marley, who is a reggae musician himself, is touring Italy this year, and they're showing this film during the jazz festivals as well?
I'm sure it'll be very popular. And, you know, the reggae rhythms and the counterpoint rhythms of, you know, become part of, I suppose, our consciousness of music. So he contributed a great deal, and the one who's touring, that son, isn't the one who appears in the film, and one of the daughters does appear, but he used Rastafarian beliefs to be fairly, how shall I say, womanizing. And so he
yes,
had 11
you say
children.
It. How many children did he have?
11, from seven different mothers. But his wife appears throughout the film. She seems to be fairly tolerant of this and was very supportive of him. She was one of the trio of backup singers for a long time as well. But she appears very cheerfully in the film.
I was the one that he would call to get women out of his dressing room. I became his guardian angel.
So he's a complex character, and and by the end they show a Rastafarian funeral. They'd built up in the film a lot of information about Rastafarianism that I didn't know, especially the role of Haile Selassie as the kind of reincarnation of Christ, and Haile Selassie going to Jamaica and being hailed there. So a bit exotic, and then the growing of the locks, all those kinds of things. But they all feature, so I found that by the end, I'd had quite a complex experience of the person, of the singer, of Jamaica, of the religion.
It is mentioned often in the Bible that there shall be a music that all people shall play and dance and sing with. What other music could that be? Reggae.
And the politics. And I was very satisfied having seen the film. My friend actually reckoned he counted on the credits for 72 different songs.
Just the final word for the director, Kevin MacDonald, who has won awards for other portraits of historical figures as well.
Yes, he got an Oscar for his documentary about the Munich massacre at the Olympic Games in 72, and did a very good documentary about mountain climbing in Peru, Touching the Void, which I must say, watching it, was very vivid about mountains and climbing. But in his feature films, he did The Last King of Scotland about Idi Amin, for which Forrest Whitaker won the Oscar for Best Actor. He actually made another film called The Eagle about Romans in Scotland, which wasn't so good. But he'd made a documentary about Klaus Barbie, which I found fascinating. Not only Barbie and his war record in France, but his escaping and his going to Bolivia and his life in Latin America during the 60s and 70s. So Kevin MacDonald, I think, has proven himself good at feature films, but certainly excellent at documentaries.
So let's recommend Marley for a whole series of reasons.
Yes, even for people who don't know the music so well, but are interested in, I suppose, society, culture.
The most important thing culturally that was happening in Jamaica at that time was Bob Marley exploding onto the world stage.
There was that sense that he's about to be massive.
That's all from the English feature programme today and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.va. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.